This is a special edition of Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On Wednesday night, I moderated Solving It Together, a community forum sponsored by the Charlotte Observer. After an historic and tumultuous legislative session, it was an opportunity for citizens to ask questions directly to members of the Mecklenburg County delegation to the General Assembly. On the stage, in alphabetical order according to their respective chambers, were House Republican Bill Brawley from Matthews, Charlotte Democrat Beverly Earle, and Charlotte Republican Ruth Samuelson. On the Senate side, we were joined by Democrats Dan Clodfelter and Malcolm Graham from Charlotte, and Republicans Bob Russo from Matthews and Jeff Tart from Cornelius. The Observer received over 400 questions in advance from readers, sifted through them, and found that the topics that floated to the top of the list were the voter ID bill, legislative decisions surrounding education, and the moves mostly initiated by the Mecklenburg delegation involving control of Charlotte Douglas International Airport. So those are the topics we focus on this hour. Most of the questions will come from the people who submitted them to the Observer, but I asked the first one, which reflected the tone of most of the questions citizens of this region submitted. Given the extraordinary representation Mecklenburg County now has in Raleigh, with the former Charlotte mayor as governor, a speaker of the House from Cornelius, an important state senator from Matthews, even a lieutenant governor who is the son of a former Charlotte mayor, many people in Democratic Mecklenburg County feel that laws passed during the last legislative session did not speak for them. So I asked Ruth Samuelson if she felt the laws she helped pass were in the best interest of all Mecklenburg residents.
I really do think they were in the best interest. People forget that we are parents and we have children in the education system, that we are also taxpayers, that in many cases we run businesses as well. I've lived in Charlotte since I was 2 years old. And while some of us here may disagree with what we did, I feel very strongly that our intent was to do what we thought was best in the interest of all of Mecklenburg County and all of the state of North Carolina. And we may all disagree with some of that, but that was clearly my intent.
Hey, let's hear from a Democrat on this panel. Let's hear from Malcolm Graham.
Well, from my perspective, no. If you are a teacher, if you are a worker, if you are unemployed, if you are sick and need medical attention, Medicaid, if you are a taxpayer, if you are a voter, if you have an interest in what's happening at the Charlotte Douglas International Airport, then from my perspective, as a delegation and as a senator, we did not put our best foot forward representing the citizens of Mecklenburg County. Of Mecklenburg County and the citizens of North Carolina. So I clearly understand, Mike, that we all have our own opinions, and I respect everybody's opinion on the dais. But from my perspective, from my opinion, we as a state went 20 years backwards.
Because there's so many of you and so many questions and so many topics, we're going to try to limit the number of responses to each question. But is anybody else up here wanting to say something?
I'd like to touch on that, if I may. If you look at results, and, you know, Senator Graham talks about all the success that's been going on. But if something we've studied over the last 3 years, trying to find how do we make North Carolina a better place, when we look at personal income since 1997 has declined. That means every single person's paycheck has decreased under the great time that Senator Graham said was going on. If you look at, despite billions of dollars of government, if you look at billions of dollars of government assistance that that has been provided for many people in the state because of need, and then all of a sudden, you know, you look at Gene Nichols' series of articles on poverty, and you have to ask yourself, why is it that poverty is increasing in the state of North Carolina? Why is it that government dependency is still there? And then you look at the fact that Jim Hunt's institute did a study on education, and specifically preparedness of a fourth and eighth grader on reading competency, and I think somewhere around 40% something close to that. Those students did not achieve reading competency at a significantly poor level. And then lastly, something that we tried very hard to do is to rejuvenate the economy and provide jobs. And when we walked in January of 2011, we faced what was Depression-era times, especially in unemployment, and worked very hard to do that because North Carolina was ranked fifth and subsequently in between five and three, third rank in the United States as far as the worst unemployment. A lot of it comes from the national level, but it isn't as rosy as people would like to have you hear it. And what we're saying is there is a better way of solving the problem, and as Representative Samuelson said, and I will say, we have taken great strides to make it a better place.
Okay, let me stop you there, and let's move to some of the topics that we are going to talk about on this broadcast portion of the show tonight. The Charlotte Observer received 400 questions, more than that actually, from people, and they seem to center around three fundamental topics: voting, education, and the airport. So let's start with voting. It was called the Voter ID Bill, but it contains a lot more than that. It just did a requirement to get a government ID to vote. The law compresses the time for early voting. It ends straight ticket voting. It ends pre-registration of teens. It would no longer count provisional ballots cast in the wrong precinct. It limits disclosure of outside campaign spending, ends public financing for judicial races, and no longer makes candidates take responsibility for their ads. First question comes from our audience, and Joanne Trotman.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to ask this question. Where is the evidence of voter fraud in North Carolina? What are the numbers reported of voter ID fraud from 2008 to 2012?
And I was told to ask Bob Russo about this, but you kind of just talked a long time, but go ahead.
Well, we just need to make sure the record is straight, Mike. And so under the circumstances, what we're looking at is, in 1997, I was one of the first persons to submit the early voting to try to accommodate the change in society, making it easier for people to vote. The system is not in place to identify people that are cheating or using some kind of fraud. There are a number of personal instances where people say, you know, I went there to vote and someone told me that I'd already voted. What we're trying to do is establish a level of honesty and integrity within the electoral process to make sure that we rebuild a level of confidence from the people to their government.
But what about the answer to the question, which was numbers? The question was about raw numbers. Bill Brawley?
Jim Gulley held my seat before I did. We both live in Precinct 218. Jim Gulley's mother was in a nursing home in Precinct 217. He picked her up and took her to vote. She was told she had already voted. She does not drive. She couldn't walk far. And no one at the nursing home claimed to have taken. Let me finish.
All right. Let me relay out the rules of engagement here. Please don't call out things to the legislators assembled here, and please let's keep a civil tongue on both sides of the stage. Go ahead.
Jim Gulley went to the Board of Elections and attempted to file a complaint of voter fraud. He was told he was not a registered voter in Precinct 217 and could not file a complaint for voter fraud outside the precinct in which he lived. Jim went and got his mother and took her to the Board of Elections to file a complaint in voter fraud, and she was told because she did not witness the action, she could not open a complaint of voter fraud. There was no record of a complaint of voter fraud in that instance, and that has kept the possibility of investigating voter fraud at a very low number.
So what you're saying is that there are no There's anecdotal evidence of voter fraud, but there's no hard numbers on voter fraud.
That is true, but it is also worth noting that the party of the governor will automatically have a majority of the members of the boards of elections in every county in the state, regardless of registration within that state. So, you know, it's I realize it's anecdotal. People say, well, there's no evidence of voter fraud, but I believe it's out there.
I know Beverly Earle wants to talk about this. I know that Ruth Samuelson wants to talk about this. Beverly?
Well, to answer the question, I don't know of any evidence. And when we were having these hearings, we had folk to come and swear to us that there had been no voter fraud or very, very limited, not enough to suppress the vote of everybody across the state. And basically what this is, it's about voter suppression. When we first started off, we started off talking about voter ID. This bill that passed the legislature is no longer about voter ID. It's about suppressing the vote. It's
and
about
that,
keeping
and that, and that brings us to our second question from Vivian Brenner. Vivian?
The proposed voting law changes make no sense to the average voters. Why would we shorten the early voting period, which is so popular that people stand in line for hours? Why discontinue pre-registering 17 and 18-year-olds? We want to promote interest and understanding of our election process. Why isn't a school-issued ID card sufficient? Why can't a student vote where they are going to school rather than having to do it by absentee ballot? If we are to have a fair, open, and democratic government, don't these acts restrict voting unfairly and close poll board doors for many people?
A lot of questions in there, Ruth Samuels.
I think I can get some of them. First, let me correct some errors, and then I'll make a statement that actually ties into what I was going to say before. While the number of days of early voting are shorter, the number of hours by law are exactly the same. So the number of hours and the number of access will actually be increased, because rather than having one poll opened somewhere for a few days, you'll have to have them opened everywhere you're going to have them open for a longer number of hours, and it has to be the total. On the student ID, the students can still register to vote where they're going to college. There's nothing stopping that. So if a student wants to register in the town, if they live there to meet the residency requires, they will still be able to do it. They will not, once we get to the voter ID part, be able to use their student ID card. They'll have to use an ID card. And the interesting thing is every college we looked up requires a photo ID to register for college. So they've already had a photo ID to register for college, and so we figured they already had one. On the registering 16 or 17-year-olds, there was some disagreement on that, and that's one that one day we may look at and do something differently on. But overall, this goes back to the question of fraud. And as they were saying before, part of the reason we don't have records is because, unlike every other area of business, Medicaid, IRS, everything else that involves power or money, we have a system in place to detect fraud. And we expect fraud, and we see fraud. And yet in politics, where we deal with both money and power, we have a defunct system to detect fraud, and we don't have a system in place to guard against it. And so in our view, we were trying to figure out a way to measure it and figure out a way to prevent it. If we do it in every other area of life, why would we not do it on voting?
Very quickly, before I go to Malcolm Graham and Senator Russo, just by a round of applause, how many of you would be okay with the voter ID bill if it was just requiring a government-issued ID and nothing else? Okay. Senator Graham.
The disappointing thing on the ID was that it did get glommed into so many other things that had nothing to do with voter fraud and voter ID, absolutely nothing to do with it. And then the other disappointing thing was there were proposals that would have addressed the issue of impersonation, because that's really the only thing the photo ID deals with, is impersonation. There's lots of other kinds of voter misbehavior and election official misbehavior that could have been addressed. Impersonation could have been addressed by a number of bills that were introduced that would have made it very easy for people to get photo IDs at the polling place. You have to provide an ID when you register. And a bill introduced by Senator Clark from Fayetteville would have provided a mechanism where when you first show up to vote after registering, a photograph is taken of you at the polling place and a sticker is put in the book permanently. You don't have to carry the photo ID around. You don't have to go to the Board of Elections in order to show your ID after the election. It's in the poll book permanently, and you don't have to worry about carrying it around with you.
And that didn't pass because
it would have been a very cheap proposal, much cheaper than what was actually passed. It defies logic as to why that was not given consideration.
Very quickly, Senator Graham, and I believe you, Mr. Senator Chart, you want to talk about this as well.
Well, the only fraud that's being perpetrated is on the citizens of North Carolina, because there is no evidence of voter fraud, and you can get struck by lightning before you identify the cases are. Listen, why can't you go vote straight Democratic or straight Republican if you want to? You can't do that anymore. The rationale was you should vote for the person, not the party. Well, you can do that under the old system. Why can 16 and 17-year-olds come to Raleigh, serve as pages in the House and the Senate, but yet can't pre-register to vote? Why are we not allowing college IDs? We have 16 publicly funded state institutions, Carolinas, State, East Carolina, UNC Charlotte. We have significant private institutions, Duke, Elon, Johnson C. Smith, yet these students are denied access. Final point. My daughter is the SGA Attorney General for Winston-Salem State University. Their first week in school, they were fighting to keep their polling place open. A student at Elizabeth City State University, a senior, wants to run for city council, but they're saying that his dormitory address doesn't count. Appalachian State University, they're losing their voting precinct. This bill disproportionately impacts people of color, the elderly, students, and those who care about the democratic process.
And Senators Russo and Tart. Senators Russo and Tart, what is your response to all of that?
I don't believe that. The reality is that 75% of the people in North Carolina believe, if you look at the recent Elon poll, that a photo ID is something that should be required because people are concerned about honesty and integrity. Let's talk about the issue of 17-year-olds registering. The law is clear on this. 18-year-old, you can vote. If your birthday is earlier than November of election, you actually can register or pre-register 6 months earlier than the primary. If you are 18 for the November election, you can actually vote in that primary. So there's nothing that precludes those early voting for 17. It helps the operation of the boards of elections so that they can operate and pay close attention to the election process and do it efficiently. This provides no roadblock. There is no voter suppression in any manner. Representative Samuelson said very clearly, you have more hours at the same locations, more voting booths for people to vote. Now, if you were out there as I was out there, you waited an hour and a half, 2 hours in some of the elections, we would expect to see that reduced. So what's wrong with that? Putting honesty in and letting it to run efficiently.
Senator Chart.
Yeah, just a couple points. First of all, so everybody's clear, this really is two bills. So don't be misconstrued, and I know we're getting off a little bit, but it is a voter ID piece of legislation. And why the other components? Because it's election laws. So you've got voter ID and election laws combined. Don't misconstrue that. Second of all, at least personally, I don't have a problem with teens pre-registering, and there'll be different rationale for and against. Second thing, whether you guys all realize it or not, there's no such thing really as true straight ticket ballot voting. You don't. When you vote for a party under straight ticket, you don't vote for the president, and you don't vote for the judges. So it's only a partial, so it's misconstrued. And when you go straight ticket, sometimes you don't vote down ticket and don't vote for the judges, which is a shame. The last thing I want to leave you with is, in just real world, one family, I have three college-age kids. My oldest went to Florida his first 2 years, finished at Appalachian State. My middle son was at Georgia Tech, and my daughter's at Chapel Hill. My son at Georgia Tech, it's a four-hour drive. He's both absentee voted, and he's come home for election day. They let him off to come vote. my oldest son in Florida, which is, I'm totally comfortable either way. And my oldest is a good example. He registered to vote, changed his residency, and voted. He didn't get out-of-state tuition, but he decided to vote locally, and that's fine.
Okay. I'm interested in the in one of the points you made up, but I'm not supposed to ask the question. So we'll go to Kathy Hill and let her ask the next one, which takes us back to voter fraud.
It does. But first, I'd like to read a quote from Bill Clinton today. A great democracy doesn't make it harder to vote than to buy an assault weapon.
And the question was?
If the purpose of the new voter ID law was to eliminate the likelihood of voter fraud, would you please discuss how the new law applies to absentee ballots, as absentee voting is the most obvious way to commit voter fraud?
Go ahead, Dan.
Signatures. And we went a long time trying to figure out how to do that so it wasn't overly burdensome, but also was going to help protect... the identity. And so you have to add a signature. You have to add two signatures on there, people who are witnessing that you are who you say you are when you signed the ballot and put it in there. So I'm not sure why you think that's so funny, but I guess you can find two people to commit fraud with you, but each of the people will have to sign under penalty, just like you would have to do when you go to vote. You sign under penalty, you put your name and address on there, and the idea is to make it so that it's harder for my neighbor to go pick my absentee ballot out of my mailbox, fill it out, and mail it in for me. So that was the idea.
But there are already penalties for that.
It's just to help them be able to track it and decrease the
penalties. We need to move on to another topic with Dan Klotfelter. Go ahead.
There are penalties, but there were penalties before.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There were also penalties before.
Eric Cable is next.
Good evening. My name is Eric Cable, and I am the Libertarian candidate for Charlotte City Council at large. That being said, does the voter ID bill include a provision that allows all eligible voters to acquire a free identification card if they need one? If not, then doesn't the bill require people to pay money in order to vote? And if so, isn't that a violation of the 24th Amendment?
Senator Ruscio, is it, well, Jan Klotfelter, it's okay.
It allows some people to get free ID, but not every voter. So it picks and chooses who gets a free ID and who doesn't get a free ID. The North Carolina Constitution says that there cannot be any additional qualification imposed on a voter beyond the residency, beyond the time of residency. It's a straight violation of the North Carolina Constitution. You don't even have to go to federal law.
There's some Republican disagreement over here.
It was designed to allow anybody that needs a photo ID to vote, to get a driver's license, which is a non-operation license in a special line that already exists at DMV at no cost to them. In addition to the fact, there is at least $1 million from the last I've seen that allows the individual to pay nothing for a birth certificate and or a marriage license if they need that as part of the documentation to do so. So there is no impediment to this other than the fact that you register to vote or you get an ID, which is what most people in this society have today. I'm not sure what the big issue is.
Beverly Earle.
But there is such a great inconvenience that's involved in getting this ID, especially for college students. If they've got a picture ID, a picture is a picture is a picture. Mm-hmm. So what difference does it make whether it's your college ID or whether it's a state issue? But for an elderly person, for a person with limited means, it's a total inconvenience, if not impossible, to get to where you need to go.
And Representative Brawley, we're all from Mecklenburg County, where we have a fairly decent transit system. If you're living down east and there is no bus service, there is no Lynx line, where church vans pick up people 10 at a time and take them to the polls, how does the person get a voter ID card? They haven't got a card.
Well, I wanted to make a comment on the ID and the ability more and more to get a free ID and how necessary that is. If you think about it, so many medications require a photo ID to receive them. A lot of government assistance requires a photo ID to apply. And even in the city of Winston-Salem, a photo ID is required to beg on the street. We need a full system to give people photo IDs, because without a government-supplied photo ID, in addition to not being able to board an airplane, though I suspect the folks we're talking about don't fly that much, but they are locked out. They are locked out of a lot of modern society because they have no proof of their identity. And we should make a valid government-issued photo ID available to every citizen of this country, and if necessary, at no charge, to make sure they're not locked out of anything in society.
Let's be clear. Is it free?
Yes.
Is it free?
It is free.
It is free. Because we went round and round about how to word that, which is why he and I will talk later. But my understanding is the way we worded it, it was free to anybody who's willing to sign and say, I need a free ID. Same with the documentation that goes with it. And we put in a program for the Board of Elections so that they can go out and put in systems to help people get out, to get their cards, to get educated on voting. It's called Viva. And to make sure that we gave them a phase-in time to give people time
and
to do it.
It's not this election. It's like 2016. And where do they go to get that ID card?
Well, and that's another thing we did. Normally, you can go to any of the areas that issue state ID DMV places.
That'll take till 2016.
What we added... For there are counties in North Carolina that have no DMV office, and to go back to the thing about the photo ID books, there are also precincts in North Carolina that have no internet access and don't have the ability to print in color. Because we looked at doing the print books that you talked about, and we looked at having online where they could pull it up and look online and see your picture. And so we do have also a study in there so that hopefully by 2016, you may not actually need a card ID. You may be able to do it the way that Senator Klagfelter said, but the technology is not there in our very rural counties. And what we did for them was we allowed them to set up in courthouses and other places, as long as they meet the same criteria that you would need to meet if you went to the DMV in terms of proving your identity, that they'll be able to go into these other satellite locations and get an ID card.
Up next, we get into a citizen Q&A about the airport when this special edition of Charlotte Talks continues. It's a special edition of Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. This hour, we're listening to a citizen forum from Wednesday evening sponsored by the Charlotte Observer. The questions came from Mecklenburg County citizens and focused on three major topics. We started with voter ID. Now we move on to the controversy surrounding the airport. There have been several iterations of legislation that would transfer control of the airport from the city of Charlotte to an airport commission. Under the most recent proposal, seven of the 13 commission members would be appointed by the city. The city would retain approval of bond issuance and eminent domain, but the commission would oversee daily operations and finances and hire and fire employees. That legislation is tied up in a lawsuit filed by the city. The first question came from Charles Shepard.
I have a question in three parts. The first part is, what started the North Carolina legislature on their quest to take control of the Charlotte airport? Number two, was there a problem with the daily operation of the airport that brought their attention? And last is, what gives the North Carolina legislature the right to take control of the Charlotte airport?
Senator Russo, I know that I'm Senator Char, I'll get to you, but you seem to be the spearhead on this, at least from our point of view in the newspaper. Go ahead.
I'll start it off, and I know there, Representative Brawley and Representative Samuelson will say something. The reality is, I think everyone understands the importance of the airport. First of all, your premise about stealing the airport or taking the airport is totally wrong. Apparently, you might have been reading the newspaper too many times, because that's not true. But in reality, that is not taking it. What it does is allows a regional commission, and if you look, regionalization in Mecklenburg County and the Charlotte region, whether it's sewer and water or transportation, that it also includes a regional type of airport, provides good leadership for the future growth of North Carolina and North Carolina's airport. The state of North Carolina doesn't receive one penny from airport operations, not one penny, nor will it receive any further from that. The other part, if I remember your question right, was dealing with the operations. Some of you that might have been here long enough, I been here since 77, remembers John Belk, Harvey Gantt, Richard Vinroot, Sumarik, all of those past mayors were great leaders for this state, along with some very competent city council members. This administration that has taken over about 3 years ago decided to get involved with micromanaging that airport. And reality is, you want someone, and all the other past mayors were allowed the airport administrator at that point, or Mr. Orr or Mr. Birmingham before that, to operate and then just measure the results. They didn't get involved with telling them they're going to have police or they're going to have certain bonds or certain issues. And you have to understand something. Every time the city got involved in that, it cost the airport more money to operate. The only success for that airport being there, since we don't have the population density as Atlanta or Miami, is because we have a low-cost airport. Every single time the city council acted, along with the mayor, it raised the cost of operations, and that puts the airport in jeopardy. That's nothing, excuse me, that's nothing that we wanted to see happen.
Senator Russo brought up an interesting point. He brought up the fact that the police, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, replaced the airport police, Malcolm Graham, after that incident in Boston where the young boy fell out of a, allegedly fell out of a wheel well of an aircraft that allegedly took off from Charlotte Douglas. But as far as I know, there is no forensic evidence whatsoever to indicate that that boy was even in an airplane, much less falling out of one that started at Charlotte Douglas. But that's precipitated the changeover of police protection at the airport. Given that fact, why?
The city council and the mayor fulfilled their fiduciary responsibility in reference to the Charlotte Douglas International Airport. The child did jump the fence. He was trespassing. Many believe.
How do we know?
Many believe that he was in that wheel well of that plane. Many believe he died. There were other instances of people jumping the airport fence and trespassing. That child could have easily been a terrorist. The city of Charlotte fulfilled its fiduciary responsibility by providing the type of study with the TSA, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, and others to determine that it was necessary to make a change in security at the airport to protect the citizens and those who are visiting and using that airport. Secondly, there were some issues in reference to finance at the airport. And the city of Charlotte fulfilled its fiduciary responsibility again by, one, getting the airport director out of trouble, and then secondly, by putting another layer of management to ensure that he wouldn't get in trouble again. They fulfilled their fiduciary responsibility. So for doing their job as the owners of the Charlotte Douglas International Airport for over 70 years, one of the best airports in the world, with no issues in reference to the efficiencies of operation, a model for the country and the world, they got their airport stolen from them. And so they fulfilled their fiduciary responsibility, and as a result, nameless, faceless business leaders, and we still don't know who they are today, no one has stood by this bill at all, publicly, and claiming it as their own. Our airport now is in the hands of the judges and the FAA. It's wrong. It's a number of things that were said were simply not true. There was no transparency regarding the airport takeover. The city built this airport in 70 years, and it took two committee meetings in less than 55 minutes to take it away, the first bill. The second bill that we voted on about 1:30 in the morning never even came through a Senate committee. It's wrong. The citizens of Charlotte built that airport, they maintained that airport, they invested in that airport, and they deserve to keep that airport.
Senator Claude Filkin. Senator Claude Filkin wanted to...
Mr. Shepard had a third part of his question, and that's what I want to speak to.
Okay.
The question in the third part was, what right does the General Assembly of North Carolina have to make this decision in the first place? And that's a very important question, because it's answered by the Constitution of North Carolina. And only you can insist that the General Assembly of North Carolina follow the Constitution of North Carolina. It says in black and white, very plainly, that when the General Assembly passes laws that deal with airports and seaports, it must pass those on a statewide basis. It cannot single out one airport, one harbor, or one seaport and pass a law specific to that institution. That's a limitation you voted for and put in the Constitution of North Carolina. It's why the matter is in court today. That was completely ignored throughout this entire process.
Mike Holland is in the audience.
I guess I'm guilty of one of those who reads the Charlotte Observer too much. An airport authority may indeed be a good idea, I don't know. But why? Just why did you feel the need to blindside Charlotte leaders with this concept instead of first introducing it as a possibility and then sitting down like adults, all sides included, and reasonably discussing it over a period of time to assure for fairness and integrity? Why the immediacy, and why such a we versus they approach to such an impactful issue?
Representative Brawley, why don't you take that and then follow up on the other side of the question that you wanted to follow up on?
Well, I wanted to, partially though, while I'm not an attorney, I did want to rebut something that Senator Klobuchar said. There is a section in the North Carolina Constitution that relates to the state establishment of port and airport facilities, and that was put there to allow the creation of the Global Transpark in eastern North Carolina. All of the bills that the city of Charlotte has requested for the airport since that amendment to the Constitution were run as local bills and have not been questioned by the city as they were city requests, but they were not statewide bills or what are called public bills. And the particular issue that we were dealing with, the airport management, was therefore properly a local bill, according to the attorneys with the General Assembly. Jerry Cohen, who is one of our main bill drafters, actually prepared the brief for the judge that explained the difference between the two sections of the Constitution. The police were added to Charlotte Airport, but they weren't put on the apron. They were inside the terminal. Whether or not the young man climbed upon the airplane, he did not go through security and jump out of the gate. He climbed the fence. That was not addressed in the changes. One of the questions of why has been the question of, is the city of Charlotte trying to find a way to take money from the airport and use it for non-airport uses? Okay, I'll wait. I sat in a meeting with a Charlotte City Councilman where he explained how the city of Charlotte launders tourism money through some of their entities to get it into the general fund in violation of North Carolina law, but technically not. There were discussions in the Charlotte Observer in November about how City of Charlotte was looking at putting additional taxes or fees on parking and using that money for other projects within the city. Eventually that idea was dropped. There were discussions reported in the Charlotte Observer about uses for the money. Then people would say, well, we're just talking about it. We don't really mean that. The Transportation Committee for the Charlotte City Council and the chairman of that committee, along with the mayor of Huntersville, for the Metropolitan Transit Commission, did a study in which they posited that the west route for the streetcar should be run onto airport property, that once it crossed the fence, all of the cost of the construction from that point on would be charged to airport landing fees. In addition, they could save additional money by building the maintenance facility for the streetcar line on the airport property and the storage facility for the streetcar line on the airport property. These would be then billed to airport landing fees. In addition, they would subsidize the operation of the route when it went to the airport with airport landing fees, and would also subsidize the fares for employees while charging a premium for passengers. This was once again questioned. This at least violates the spirit of both state and federal law, if not the letter. And we were told, well, it's just an idea, it's a report. Now, I got a question for you. A lot of y'all are married, you're in permanent relationships. Go home tonight, say to your partner, you know, I think my life would be a lot more exciting if I started dating. And then tell me how that conversation goes. Why are they talking about ways of taking money out of the airport if they have no intention to do it?
So, I have to stop you. I'm going to have to stop you there, Representative Brawley. But let's get to Mike Collins' question. And the question, why the urgency to push this through with very little discussion, very little debate? Let's get it done now.
Okay. Well, first, by legislative time frame, it was actually pretty long. It started in late January. It didn't actually pass till right before we adjourned. The governor's transportation plan, which completely revamped transportation funding, changed the way roads are built across the entire state from announcement to passage and signed into law was about 6 weeks, which is maybe a fourth of the time that we spent on the airport. The original discussions had been ongoing for some time before I became aware of them. When I got involved in early and was talking to Senator Rucho, he had a draft bill. There was a meeting between us and members of Charlotte City Council.
So, in your opinion, it was not a short amount of time.
It was not a short amount of time, and there were discussions all the way. They weren't reported in the Charlotte Observer.
Okay, Beverly Earle, yeah. I have to move along. Beverly Earle?
That's not exactly true. The bill passed out of the Senate pretty quickly, and had the City Council not requested to meet with the delegation with full court press from the press and everybody there to slow it down, then it would have passed because it was on the fast track. It did pass the Senate probably within a week, maybe even a shorter period than that. And it was held in the House for some discussion, but the first bill did pass very quickly. And but you know, I just wanna say why, the question as to why we even dealt with that was because we could, because they could. There's a supermajority, and anything that wants to be passed can be passed without consulting the rest of the delegation, without consulting the minority party.
Was the same thing true with the Democrats?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I have been there. I'm the senior person, as you can probably tell from the delegation. And we offer them many, many more opportunities than what we have received during the past two sessions, especially this session, because there is a supermajority.
All right, let me move along to another. Yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry, but as the person who's taken the most heat in the Charlotte Observer on this issue, I do feel like I ought to be able to say something. I mean, it just...
All right.
And I actually want to answer the question that the gentleman asked, which was, why was it hurried and why didn't you sit down like adults and talk? And I will tell you that we tried. She's correct that it passed quickly through the Senate. And from the very beginning, I told the members of the City Council, I said, when it gets to the House, we will hold it and we will work with you. And when it got to the House, we said to them, what is it you want to do? And they said, we want to hire a study. We said, fine, hire a study. This is when we think we're getting out of here, because we do run on a shorter schedule than the regular City Council does here. We said, you can hire your study. I need it. We need it back by May 1 because we're going to be able to fit it in what we thought was going to be a short session. They hired their study. It came back. They didn't like the answer. I went back to them and we said, okay, you got your answer. I understand you don't like it. Will you sit down and talk to us? Will you sit down and work with us? We got an answer that was very emphatically, no, we will not. So then we said, okay, we tried a number of ways for weeks to get them to sit down with us and they refused. We then crafted a study in early June. And the study, by the time we finished it, the study gave the city 7 named appointments, the legislature 5. We gave them the right to name 7, and we were going to name 5. They had one of the chairmanships, we had one of the chairmanships. They could call meetings, we could call meetings. It would have been public. All of these issues would have been discussed in public. And then we put in writing that when we came back in the short session, we would not pass any legislation that did not conform with what the study said. They refused. So you can be upset with us, But we felt like there were problems at the airport. They felt like there were not problems at the airport. We said, let's be adults and chat, and they said no.
If I have candy and you're trying to take my candy, why am I going to sit down with you to tell you how to take it and what's the best way to take it?
And with that, I need to move on because we're very short on time.
I want to go back a minute. And I want to say that what I hope comes out of this whole sad affair, regardless of what side of the issue you're on, is that we collectively will agree, and with our colleagues in the front row, that we won't do it this way again.
Ruth, hold a second.
I've got the mic right now, Ruth, please. Thank you. When I started out, except for Beverly, I've been there longer than any of the other current serving members, there was a tradition in this delegation. It started long before I got there. It was started by the leadership of the business community in this city, who said to the legislators then serving, you cannot air your dirty laundry in front of the rest of the state of North Carolina. If you will link arms, work things out within your delegation, come to some understanding among the group of you, there is nothing that can stop you in Raleigh. And they were right. And over the last 20 years, they have consistently been proved right. We, this delegation, Mecklenburg County delegation of the legislature, was the envy of most other large urban delegations in the General Assembly for the last 20 years, because we did work our issues out and bring them to the table united. There have been breakdowns of that in the past, but by and large, that has been the tradition that's been honored. And what I hope we do is that we take from this lesson a resolve that we will not repeat it, but we will go back to that tradition that was very successful in getting what this county wanted.
We have about 5 minutes left. I've got to move on to another topic. Education. Under the state budget, teacher pay will remain near the bottom of national rankings, although starting next year, raises will be based on teacher effectiveness. More than 3,850 teacher assistant positions will be gone. The extra pay for teachers who earn master's degree phased out. Teachers who already make that money, however, will be able to keep it. The budget also phases out tenure. Low-income families will be now eligible for $4,200 opportunity scholarships to help pay for private schools. Students with disabilities get $6,000 for private education. And let's begin with a question about education from Elizabeth Domenico.
If jobs and education are important concerns, how do you justify getting rid of so many teaching assistants?
Senator Tarr.
Well, let's start with, it's a great question. And I know there's a lot of information floating around how we've cut teacher positions, issues around the teaching assistants, issues with the budget. I've seen numbers. I read The Observer every day, cover to cover, believe it or not. And one of the numbers you hear floating is that we've cut the education and K-12 spending $500 million. I will tell you that's absolutely not true. My chief of staff has a copy of the budget. This, in the next biennium, we will raise K-12 spending $351 million in that biennium. In teachers' assistance, yes, we've reduced the budget 20%. But what's happened in what's called the local education agencies, the LEAs, the local groups, they have already been cutting back about $70 million a year on TA spend already. We took it up about 120, but there's still $450 million being spent on teacher assistants going forward. Yes, and I will tell you, as a teacher, my daughter-in-law is a teacher. I've got family members that are. Being ranked 48th in teacher average pay is an embarrassment for the state. Now, hold on. No. But here's the thing we got to recognize. Right now, to go from 48th to being in the top half, it's $3,441 additional average salary. It's a doable thing to accomplish and move significantly if it's a priority for all of us to decide because we're competing on needs. But here's the thing that's misleading. 48th ranked overall teacher pay, but as a state, our responsibility, contribution to teacher pay, we are ranked 28th in the country. So what's different? What's different is the contribution at the municipal and the county levels. Now, in Mecklenburg, we do a great job. We added an additional $6,400 per student. In Allegheny's example, it's tough. Poor counties, they add $200. So when we factor Robeson and these other counties that don't have the funds, that drives our overall average down and kind of misleads a little bit where we are. What's interesting, teacher pay.
last biennium, and we you know, it's something we could argue is not that great. But we bumped salaries, gave a bump in the pool, because we don't set the salaries, we set the base. Then the individual school districts set the overall pay by individual, which is appropriate. But in that, 2 years ago, we gave like a percent bump. In this budget, next year, not this year, but the following one, there'll be a 1.2% bump in pay. Now, it doesn't sound great, but we are ranked the 12th best state in the last 10 years for teacher pay raises. Now, is that good or bad? No, probably not. But relatively, you know, we're right there.
But the rubber meets the road when the paycheck hits the bank every 2 weeks in the, for a teacher, I suppose. And Laura Henry, you have a question about recruitment, given what's happened here.
How does North Carolina plan to attract and recruit the best educators after eliminating tenure and master's level teaching supplements and placing their salaries in the bottom tier of the country?
The best two teachers I know are teaching at lower pay in private schools simply because they like the environment better. While the worst teacher I have ever known was allowed to retire when every mom at Bain Elementary School and every teacher knew she was the worst. The bottom line is we need, we want, and we want to pay the best teachers.
And I have to stop you there because that's all the time that we have for the special Solving It Together broadcast. We'd like to thank all seven members of the Mecklenburg County delegation from the General Assembly for being with us tonight for this hour. We'd also like to thank the Charlotte Observer for sponsoring this event. Thank you for listening. Good night.